tres, cuatro.
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week, we're joined by Nashville singer-songwriter Margo Price.
Her brand of country music is rooted in tradition, but she's not caught up in the current hype surrounding outlaw country.
I don't know. I think that there's a lot of people in the mainstream that are being turned on their heads right now and really grasping for authenticity. But that being said, I think it's only a matter of time before the Americana outlaw bubble bursts.
We'll also revisit our conversation with the late Anthony Bourdain. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we'll have an interview and a live performance with Margo Price. But first, we have to pay tribute to the late Anthony Bourdain. We are replaying a conversation we aired with Anthony Bourdain in 2008. 8 books total, 4 different hit television shows, an incredible man, dead at the age of 61 on June 8th in France by his own hand. You know, why did we have this chef, this raconteur, this television host on our show? At the risk of getting all sappy, you and me believe that music remains the greatest force in the world to unite people who may have strong differences, people we don't know, people we're afraid of. Bourdain felt that way about food. I am a food fan as well as a music fan. I know so are you. And Bourdain was a music fan as well as a food fan. The way he talked passionately about food is the way we try to talk about music, and we talked about music with him. We began our conversation by asking Anthony Bourdain to explain the similarities between the rock and roll lifestyle and that of a chef.
There's a lot of overlap, I think, in you know, the talent pool. You know, the kitchen has always been sort of a refuge for misfits, marginal characters who kind of instinctively understand that the 9-to-5 world is not for them. I think what's been missed as well is that our hours coincide. I mean, certainly when I came up in the business in the early and mid-70s, you know, musicians like to hang out in bars. We have a bar in our restaurant. You know, musicians get off work 2 a.m. We get off 2 a.m. So it wasn't really a stretch. You know, musicians like free food. We like, you know, to get into concerts for free. So there was a lot of overlap there.
What about that interest in music? I mean, what came first for you? You obviously were a very accomplished chef early on, but that scene back then, you were intimately involved and seemed like you were going beyond the surface level music. So obviously you'd been into music for a while as well.
Well, my father worked for Columbia Records when I was a kid. And, you know, so I was on sample service early on. You know, my dad would come home, though he worked in Columbia Masterwork Division, classical music division. He'd come home, you know, when I was a little kid with, you know, here, Tony, this is, you know, Sgt. Pepper's. Everybody at the office in the A&R department says, you know, this is the greatest record ever. You should listen to it. You know, I had to remind him of this years later as, don't blame me for the drugs, Dad. You gave me that album, you know. So that was, you know, I grew up in a musical family where music was important and it was something we noticed and where I tended to be aware of the best albums, the best records of the time, as, you know, often before they were released.
So after getting off work in the kitchen, you'd be hanging in the early 70s with the Ramones, with, you know, the members of the New York punk scene, the Dead Boys.
I'd see the Dead Boys around. I mean, I was a big Richard Hell and the Voidoids fan. You know, I got the vapors when Richard Hell would come in, you know, for a glass of bourbon and his scrambled eggs in the morning. You know, that was a big deal to me.
Yeah.
Late last night.
And what was special about that, I guess, is that no one else knew who they were. I mean, the punk thing was, this was music you never heard on the radio and was not referred to in any magazine and was basically invisible and inaudible to everyone everywhere for the most part for quite some time. So it was special, you know.
You know, you mentioned the bourbon and the eggs in the morning. What would these guys eat? I mean, what, you know, were they as interested in food as you were in music?
I think they were just starving. I mean, they didn't eat enough. You know, a lot of that money went to dope. Food was sort of a secondary consideration. I mean, if you look at how a lot of those guys were living, it was pretty close to the margins. And of course, they're not making any money. You know, maybe their girlfriends are making money, you know, stripping or dancing or whatever, which was a popular way to make a living at the time.
So would you slide them a meal occasionally?
Yeah, I remember I was a big Johnny Thunders fan, and we managed to network a free meal for him. You know, we had him come in and eat at the restaurant. He came in all dressed up, you know, little tie, little tuxedo jacket, and terrified. That's the thing that struck me. He was really intimidated. Like he'd never eaten in a fine dining situation before. And I remember when he was offered, like, would you like, you know, red or white? You know, he just had them both mixed in his glass. And, you know, it was like a little kid. And it was very, you know, sweet.
Yeah, that's cool.
You make the point philosophically that that music can affect what's going on in your kitchen. You have played punk rock at different times, but now there are different soundtracks. Could you talk a little bit about how the stuff that none of us hear or see, because we know we're sitting out at the table, right? What's going on in the kitchens where you have worked and like to work, and what's the soundtrack?
Well, a lot of chefs now, it's, you know, total silence during the service period. You know, there's going to be no music at all. But, you know, a mid-range joint like mine, chances are, you know, when I was working in the kitchen every day, during prep, I liked soundtrack to Superfly, Curtis Mayfield, early sort of pre-disco funk, maybe a little George Clinton, you know, that kind of sound.
Establishing a groove.
During the service period, you know, you're kind of fighting for music, for DJ position, or at least you're trying to accommodate a lot of different tastes. You know, maybe a little punk, you know, Dead Boys early on. But then I got to kind of swap for some, you know, Mexican thrash metal or Mexican pop songs and stuff like that, with the majority of my kitchen are, of course, Mexican. You know, when I'm getting out of the kitchen, then you get into, you know, more adrenaline-based stuff, I guess. You know, then it's definitely Ramones all the way.
Because you got to get through to the end of the night.
Or, you know, classic stuff. Give you that one more shot of adrenaline to propel you out into the night.
The day's just beginning. Beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with the baseball
bat. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, ho. But do you think that what the cooks are listening to can be tasted in the end result? I mean, that's a philosophical heavy question.
I know some chefs who definitely, on the more creative end, who get flavors from sound. You know, they actually get inspired creatively by listening to music. I'm not like that. I was always, first of all, I wasn't that creative a chef. I was more of a workhorse journeyman guy. But most chefs, I think, use music for release. You know, afterwards, it could kind of, you're looking for a pleasurable oblivion, or to take you out and away from the kind of coal mine situation you've been in. So I don't know what that's like. You know, I'm not inspired to cook by music. I like to cook to music. If I'm alone in my kitchen, you know, just cooking for a few friends, that's different. Then that's a whole different kind of groove. I could be going, you know, old, anywhere from Dean Martin. You know, I like old, like, cheesy British gangster film soundtracks. Like, I mean, very into the Get Carter soundtrack now in a big way.
Well, that's an interesting area, because I wanted to ask you this. And I think it's one of the key questions in my life. Like, what do you play when you have people over for dinner? It's like, okay, what complements this meal? And so you have six guests over, and you're cooking dinner for them. What do you put on? Does it depend on what you're serving? Does it depend on who they are?
Definitely, I think Serge Gainsbourg is good for French. You know, maybe Serge Gainsbourg with Brigitte Bardot, that wonderful single.
Yeah. Elle est belle et son prénom c'est Bonnie.
À eux deux, ils forment le gang Barrow. You know, something that's evocative of France, if that's what you're doing with the food. And Italy, you know, definitely you're falling into that kind of, you know, Connie Francis, you know, you're talking Dean Martin.
So you're going to go old school, or you're going to stick with like the old school pizza joint kind of soundtrack.
I don't want to hear Portishead, and, you know, I don't want dining lounge music in the background. You know, that's so ubiquitous. Yeah. I'm not serving chocolate martinis. Why should I play chocolate martini music? You know. Mm-hmm.
So it's not sort of an ambient thing. It's like you don't want this sort of sifting in the background where people can sort of talk over it.
You see, I've always gone that direction.
Yeah.
Because Eric Satie said that ambient music is music that mingles with the knives and forks at dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't play Satie. That's too whip. But I always I opt out with Eno. Because, you know,
yeah.
You know, my in-laws won't object to Eno. Somebody hipper knows that it's Eno.
You know, I'll put on the, you know, for the hipper crowd, I'll put on McCoy Tyner. For, like, the little less hip crowd, George Winston. You know, kind of solo piano.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want anything too interfering with, you know, you don't want anybody to, you know, harsh their mellow, whatever it is,
so,
while they're
so
eating.
So metal know? Machine music would be out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
There's probably music that could interfere with digestion, physically.
And friendships.
Yeah,
that's
right.
I'm asking. And the same thing for setting the mood in a restaurant. I'd love to hear the amazing soundtrack that's going on while you're cooking in the back. But what about the folks out front eating? What do you set for them musically?
Innocuous, you know. It's if in my restaurant, it's like Edith Piaf and, you know, French chanteurs and, you know, stuff like that. I do like, you know, kind of early 60s French pop sometimes. But really innocuous. So you don't want to distract from the meal. I mean, that's true at home as well. You don't mm-hmm. want people to stop the conversation dead to admire what a, you know, forward-thinking genius you were when you bought the album. You know, that's just, it's like people who used to, you know, stand up and show you that they could recite every line from a Fire Sign Theater or a Frank Zappa album. You know,
right.
There's something a little creepy about that.
It's too
know?
Much.
It's yeah,
too
it's
much.
Too much.
You're not a purist. That's what I like about your sensibilities. Like, you're just as comfortable eating a bad hot dog in a cool bar on the Lower East Side as you are in a 4-star French restaurant.
Often more so.
And I was going to say, is that, you know, I mean, you've traveled in these worlds where you're around a lot of chefs. I mean, do most chefs share that sort of sensibility where they can appreciate food at those kind of levels, or are they snobs?
I think most chefs after work want a good hot dog or something good, local, authentic, and totally without pretense. And of course, just like there are musicians, you know, people that you know, after a musician performs, they want to go see. There are chefs who tend to simplify things and, you know, cook pretty straightforward stuff.
Mm-hmm. I got to ask you about, okay, two artists that you have said you will never countenance anywhere, anytime, in any restaurant
not
that
in
you
my
ever
kitchen.
Step foot in. No Billy Joel, no Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
I am the entertainer, and I know just where I stand. Another serenader and another long-haired band.
Well, Billy Joel is actually, you know, I've said no Billy Joel is allowed in my kitchen. You know, you're fired if you've seen visibly enjoying Billy Joel. He has slipped into my kitchen on numerous occasions and sent me pictures of himself signs saying, I guess you do let Billy Joel in your kitchen. I've had dinner with him. And as I said to him, I just hate your music, man. I believe you're really talented. I mean, it's clearly you are. I just really hate that melodic kind of stuff.
And he hasn't taken a swing at you?
No, he was very cool.
Because
we've
both gotten the nasty phone calls from Joel when we dared to review him.
He's a competitive guy.
He was a very, very good guy with a good sense of humor to me. You know, I've been
this
making Billy Joel jokes for a long
this
time.
Is a testament
I just,
to
you know, so he's allowed in my kitchen anytime, just not his music.
Yeah.
The Grateful Dead, I just don't, you know, hippies. You know, anyone who likes the Grateful Dead, I have concerns about their arrival time and work ethic. You know, to start with. And I had a bitter experiences in the 60s and 70s. You know, it all sort of died and was over by the time. It was everything that I hated when the Ramones arrived and saved me. You know, endless pedal steel solos and noodling away on guitars. And, you know, the words, oh, the show was great, it went on for 7 hours. That never sounded good to me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
No, don't like it.
Well, I think you have an opposition, too, to the extended meal, too. It seemed like there's a little bit of opposition on your part. Like, why does this have to be a 4-hour extravaganza where you get the escort to the men's room when you want to go there? It's
I would be, you know, a perfect world, I would be eating the world stuff from great chefs, the best ingredients. I'd be eating with my hands, and I would not have to wear shoes. You know?
Street food. Big fan of street food.
Right, right.
What about this notion, Tony, that chefs are the new rock stars? Now, you are infamous, as we are. You know, we're critics. We put ourselves on the line. You know, when we you just went off on the Grateful Dead, you know, but you don't do that for a living. You're just a guy who has an opinion on the Grateful Dead. We can say in the paper, and we're going to get 300 emails the next day. But you take on some of the other names, some people who do TV shows but apparently never cook, you know, and you give props to guys who may be stars now but, you know, worked in the kitchen the hard way.
you know, it was fun making fun of Emeril for a while. But, you know, that's a hardworking guy who came up, you know, the hard way and deserves some success with, you know, and at least as a professional, which is probably why they're giving him the chop over at Food Network. We're going through a transitional phase here where it's really not about the food. It's not about the cooking. It's about the personalities. And I guess in a lot of the same way that MTV made a transition to, you know, I mean, how much music is on MTV anymore?
None.
So how much food is actually going to be on Food Network? I think, you know, about the same.
Do you find that there's a correlation between great music towns, cities around the world, and great food? I mean, can a town have amazing restaurants and great food with lousy music, or vice versa?
You know, that's a really good question. You know, I'm thinking about great music towns. I think, you know, people who like music tend to be sensualists. People who like food tend to be sensualists. You're open to music. You're open to food. And I think those attitudes tend to coincide more often than not.
Well, our favorite rock star chef, by all means, is Tony Bourdain. Thank you very much, Tony.
My pleasure.
That was our conversation with the late Anthony Bourdain, dead at age 61. Please call and leave your memories of Bourdain at 888-859-1800. Coming up, a conversation and performance from Margo Price in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Wild women, they don't worry,
have no time for the blues. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and this week we're talking with Nashville singer-songwriter Margo Price, who, by the way, was a guest on Anthony Bourdain's show Parts Unknown. When he went to Nashville, he prominently featured Margo. But that's not all she's known for. She is part of this generation of Nashville songwriters, up-and-comers, who are rooted in sort of a hardcore side of the country scene with really strong songwriting chops, really reinventing what it means to be a Nashville country artist. Her first album came out a couple years ago, Midwest Farmer's Daughter. It was recorded at Sun Studios in Memphis and released in 2016. Her latest, All American Made, released in 2017, signed to Jack White's Third Man Records out of Nashville. And though she's not really a country pop chanteuse, as it were, her records are both charting on the country charts, which is a real sign of new life in Nashville. She was raised in a small town in Illinois, Aledo. She is, as advertised, a Midwest farmer's daughter, as her debut album was titled. At the age of 20, she took off for college, but she shared with us that she wasn't there too long.
I came to Nashville to visit my cousin on spring break, and I dropped out and never looked back.
Your parents must have been proud.
They were so proud. They were so proud. No, they put everything on my dad's flatbed trailer and moved me down there, and we looked like the Beverly Hillbillies coming in town with just a big pile of junk all strapped in. And they were supportive. I mean, you know, I think that they wanted me to get my degree. And very shortly after I moved there, I met my husband, Jeremy, at a Belmont college party where neither of us were going to school. And we were just hanging out and partying with folks that were going to school there. And, yeah, we started writing together. And I like to say we're a 13-year overnight success.
Yeah, it's true, because there were three indie albums, right? And an EP before.
Oh, yeah, there were many, many.
Yeah.
All right, you're listening to Sound Opinions. We're here at the Goose Island Barrel House. You guys want to play a song for us?
Sure, yeah.
What are we going to hear, Margo?
Called Heart of America.
My sweet mother gets up so early in the morning. She turns on the stove and she makes a pot of coffee. My daddy filled his tractor up with diesel to plant the corn. That's how it was on the day that I was born. Well, the days they went by, and the bins filled up with grain. My mother's brother died on a motorcycle in the rain. The town, it got too big for for his britches and the government it came, and now it will never be the same. No one moves away with no money, they just do what they can to live in the heart of America, getting by on their own two hands. You can pray to anybody's Jesus and be a hard-working man, but at the end of the day, if the rain, it don't rain, we just do what we can. Sometime back in 86, the big banks took the throne. They asked that every local farmer try to dry his own corn. But the men in suits had a bigger plan than to let it be our own. When the crops came in that spring, they were blown. And Neil and Willie tried so hard in battles they have gone. But that was still long after a much bigger war had been won. No one was there to save the wheat and the cattle at my home. They took every field my family owned. No one moves away with no money, they just do what they can to live in the heart of America, getting by on their own two hands. You can pray to anybody's Jesus and be a hard-working man, but at the end of the day, if the rain, it don't rain, if the bank, it don't break, we just do what we can. We just do what we can.
Thank you.
Heart of America by Margot Price. She's here at the Goose Island Barrel House on Sound Opinions with Jeremy Ivey and Luke Schneider. What a wonderful, beautiful song.
Thank you.
So from your second album that's gotten super widespread attention, not to slight all the indie recordings before, All American Made. That means many things on different songs throughout the album, right? It seems like one of the things you're doing is really talking about this moment in America and the good things about democracy and how perhaps we're slipping away from them. And these problems, they're all American made. Am I paraphrasing correctly, Margot?
I'd say so. Yeah, but you know, when we first were thinking about the second album, it was kind of the idea to encompass all different types of American music. Which I think is one of the most beautiful things about America is that all the different genres that, you know, it's become such a melting pot. There's so many different styles of roots music to choose from. And we didn't want to do a traditional country record again. I mean, obviously there's many traditional moments on there, but we wanted to feel free to incorporate, you know, blues and folk and, you know, soul and all the things that have kind of come to fruition. If we want it to be psychedelic, then it can go there, and you know, hopefully people enjoy it and are not offended or.
For some reason, if you just play instruments and you don't add any weird effects and, you know, just play a song, people call that throwback. Yeah. You know, it's just
there's
a song
no drum
with three
machine,
chords.
So.
Yeah, and we're just playing it. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's true.
Were you inspired by the climate of the time in writing some of these songs? I mean, you talk about the pay gap
the disparity between men and women. There's an anthem for the hashtag Me Too moment. And you're talking about a lot of very timely issues. And I've read interviews where you said, you know, at the risk of offending people, let's not forget what happened to the Dixie Chicks when they dared to have an opinion. My God.
Well, luckily nobody buys records anymore, so they can't burn them. a lot of people bring up the Dixie Chicks to me, I think they were in a very different arena. You know, they were on a major label, I'm sure, and they were having lots of radio play. So I've definitely offended some people, and I would have put out the same record no matter who was in office. We wrote our song All American Made during the Obama administration. And it definitely took on new weights and new meaning after the election. But even pay gap, you know, I think that that song wouldn't feel as heavy or as much of an anthem as it does now that, you know, all these issues have come to light.
It's not that I'm asking for more than I'm owed, and I don't think I'm better than you. Say that we live in the land of the free, but sometimes that bell don't ring true. It's been that way.
Even on my first record, there was a song called This Town Gets Around, which I always say was Me Too before Me Too was Me Too.
You said, darling, sign on the dotted line, kiss my cheek and drink this wine.
You made Midwest Farmer's Daughter, shopped it around, nobody wanted it. Jack White eventually put it out, and it became a huge hit. It was a top 10 record on the country charts, I believe, without a single, which was unprecedented at the time.
And I just have to interject. You pawned your wedding ring to pay for those sessions? Is that true?
We did.
Oh, my God. That's commitment.
Were you able to buy it back ever?
Even before that, I remember the morning that Jeremy walked into the kitchen and he was like, I'm selling the car. We need money. I'm selling the car. And he was working at a sandwich shop, and I was selling vintage clothes right off my back.
Yeah, you want the shirt. Yeah.
He went down to CarMax on Gallatin Road in East Nashville, and
it's a good plug there.
He saw CarMax. Get your money today.
Yeah. It had to be done.
That's not their slogan, but hit me up, CarMax. So yeah, without him, it never would have happened because he had more faith in me than I did in myself.
Wow.
It's like singing loud, but no one left here. Been drinking from a well of inspiration, but it's all falling off.
You know, you were kind of a thing in East Nashville, right? I mean, your band was around.
I mean,
and
we were doing all right. Yeah. I think that it was always like one little thing would keep us holding on, like one write-up. Or like, I remember Kenny Vaughn seeing me in the five spot, and I was having a terrible week and feeling really depressed, thinking about pawning all my instruments and moving to, I don't know, Tangiers or something. And, you know, Kenny Vaughn was like, you've got a good thing. Keep going for it. You've got it. And that gave me another 6 months at least. Just one little compliment.
So 12. And you do have the wedding ring back now.
We did. We went and
okay,
got it back.
Right.
They didn't give me much for it because it's got a big crack in it and it's missing a couple diamonds.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He's Greg Kot. We are at the Goose Island Barrel House with Margo Price.
It wasn't a hero. All right, okay.
moved to Nashville when you're 20 with the aspirations, obviously, of, you know, here's a music town, I'm going to try to crack it. And you wrote that song, This Town Gets Around, which is one of the nastiest songs I've ever heard about any, and you're in the middle of Nashville.
In this town, everybody trying to get a piece of everybody else. It gets hard to tell a real friend from a fake one. So many promises, favors, and lies. Small stubborn city was a good disguise. Even the two have been on the way along.
Now, Nashville has this rep. It's the coolest thing, and it's also the meanest thing. I mean, one of our comrades from Chicago, Robbie Foulkes, wrote a great Nashville song, which was F This Town.
Because my friend Jimmy said Nashville had money growing right on the trees. So I thought I'd go pick some, and that don't mean musically.
Like, yeah, I heard about
20
that
years ago.
Yeah,
and it
yeah.
seems like it's the same dynamic. So what yeah. is
it just
that
get,
dynamic?
Just get Steve Earle rolling on the subject of Nashville.
People keep coming there, though, and it seems like there's some really cool things happening. So what is it about Nashville that has this sort of dark, evil underbelly that people don't seem to talk about as much as the cool stuff? What was the experience like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll probably be buried there if I'm honest. I do love it. But, you know, I think the level of talent there is just through the roof. And, I mean, not even, you know, the level of talent that we see on TV and here on the radio. It's the people who are playing, like, the dive bars and the honky-tonks and, you know, I found my whole band there, and they're all just such great pickers. And so, I think that is what is really appealing. But there are these kind of like unwritten rules and these secret societies. That's,
wow.
That, you know, you
the Illuminati
you
in Nashville, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, for saying things or for being different. I don't know. I think that there's a lot of people in the mainstream that are being turned on their heads right now and really grasping for authenticity. But that being said, I think it's only a matter of time before the Americana outlaw bubble bursts.
That's Margot Priest. Margot recently joined us for a live performance and conversation at the Goose Island Barrel House in Chicago. And after a short break, we're going to hear more from Margot Priest. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. I'm so tired.
Well, I've been traveling so long that I can't go back. 'Cause I'm too far in, I got my ticket and my bags are packed.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And this week we're joined by Nashville singer-songwriter Margot Priest at the Goose Island Barrel House. We continued our conversation with Margot by asking about her audition for the label.
Yeah, actually, I had a meeting with them and it got canceled and I was heartbroken. And then I had another meeting with them and I showed up. And they were like, oh, we're so swamped today. And I was like, I'm outside the door. Please, just, I can't wait any longer. We did, the album had been recorded for like nearly, I mean, half a year or a year at that point.
And everybody had turned it down.
I thought, like, this is my last ditch effort. And he was like, okay, well, you're here. Come on in. And had a cup of coffee and talked to him. And it was in June, and Bonnaroo was going on, so they had their... they let people come in and do like a direct to acetate, like make your own record and do a recording. And they were like, why don't you come back and just, you know, sing a song and we'll put it on a record. And it was early morning and I don't like singing early morning. And I said, I don't have my guitar, but they handed me a guitar. So I walked back in there and sang this song that Jeremy and I had just wrote after going on this terrible tour of Florida, playing to the most empty, depressing rooms you've ever seen in your whole life.
Wow, this is a real low point.
Questioning everything. And so this song was called Desperate and Depressed. And got up there and sang it. And there's some double-sided glass apparently, and so I found out later that Jack was watching and listening through the through the glass wall.
Really? He's got this thing going on, for people who don't know, when he's at home especially. What was that stupid movie about, like, the devil? Robert De Niro's the devil, and it's in Louisiana, you know, and he's got, like, long fingernails and a pinky ring. Yeah, that's what Jack reminds me of. I think it's all show. I mean, he's just a kid from Detroit, right, who used to be in Goober and the Peas, right? You yeah. know, but he likes to play that. So hiding behind the two-way mirror, I could...
I didn't find out till way later that he was back there, but I don't know. I mean, I'd sent them the album, and they loved it, but I think they just wanted to, like, see if I could sing without auto-tune or something. I don't know.
Wow. That's a little bit of pressure.
I'm glad I...
Here, play something. Can you give us, like, a verse of that song?
Yeah, sure. It says a word that might not be good for radio, so you can beep it out later. I'm pissed off at the number of people that I meet who go to shake my hand with a viper up their sleeve. They freeze me out in the winter, burn me up all summer, trying to take my money when I'm desperate and depressed. Ain't it a mess? Well, I played for free and paid for the miles on my track. Got no sleep in the motel, cause the worry keeps me up. It almost drives me crazy thinking about my baby and how he's gonna love me if I'm desperate and depressed. Can't get no rest. Mama never told me that things would be this way. If I can't find the money, then I can't buy the time, and I'm stuck here making someone else's dime.
Thank you for indulging us an impromptu version of Desperate and Depressed,
yeah,
the song
anytime.
That got Margot Price signed to Third Man Records. That's great. Here, you're a jerk. Sign me.
Yeah, we had this. The only thing we had going for us back in those days was we got a write-up in Rolling Stone, just online. And it wasn't even in print. And then we had a booking agency. And, I mean, bless their heart, they really wanted to help us, but we just didn't have any following, and they didn't really have that many connections. So they were sending us out on these tours where we were just losing money and sleeping on couches covered in cat hair. And, so that song was to them. It ends with a 10% of nothing ain't a dime. They were getting 10%. I'm like, well, fine, you can have $5.
All American Made has a Willie Nelson duet on it, which is a terrific song. There's a bunch of terrific songs on it, but Learning to Lose. So how did that work out that you got one of your heroes?
Jeremy and I wrote the song, and we were listening to a lot of Willie Nelson records at the time. And when we finished writing it, we were like, wouldn't it be so cool if we could get Willie to do that as a duet? But at the time that we wrote it, we had never met him. And then months later, we were doing all these tours with him. We were on the Outlaw Music Festival. We did Farm Aid. We did his 4th of July picnic. And got to go hang out on the bus with him. And he's so down to earth, and he's so nice. You can't even believe that he's rich and famous.
Mm-hmm.
He came into the studio, and they had a little stool set up with a little ashtray and a joint in there. And Trigger was sitting there in all of his glory. And he was just so calm and relaxed. And they told us, now, you know, if he doesn't like the song, he's going to do it once. And that's it. we can't ask him to do it again. He's just going to do it however many times he wants, and you'll just have to be happy with what you got. So we were ready for, you know, they're like, he usually only does like two takes at the most. But I think he did like four or five, and he was just so, he was so into it, and he told us, you know, several times what a great song it was, and it was really hard to pick which lead. I mean, he did so many amazing leads. We're like, how do we pick which trigger solo we want?
Won't you tell me how long must I pay all these dues? Won't you tell me it's when I learn a clue? Said it, oh, but say that it's not true. It's
when we wrote it, with one question we kept asking is, what Willie Nelson song are we ripping off? What is this? You know, this is the song. So we go through phases and stages. We go through Shotgun Willie and like, no, it's not that one. Like, I don't know what it is. So when he got done tracking, we went out in the room, kind of hung out for a minute, and he shook our hand and said, what a great song. I said, well, we're just, you know, trying to rip you off the best we can. And he said, I didn't write that song. And that was a good confidence, like, you know, you didn't rip me off, you know.
Yeah. So cool. That was cool.
Yeah.
Of course, you might have, and he just forgot.
Maybe
it's
so.
It's possible.
Yeah, you know, a little bit of fog there, but.
We'll wait for the lawsuit.
Yeah.
Wonderful songs. I think the core of what Margot Price and Jeremy Ivey and Luke Schneider have been able to accomplish is the songwriting. Jeremy and Margot as a team on many of these songs. And I'm thinking about, you come from a songwriting tradition in a way, Margot, in your family. Your uncle was a guy who had a similar story to you in that he wasn't an overnight success, but ended up writing songs for a lot of important country artists. Yeah. Was that story inspirational to you? And did he ever say to you, Margot, don't do it. You're crazy if you do this.
Oh, he gave me some tough love advice, that's for sure. My Uncle Bobby Fischer, he's still living in Nashville. He's in his 80s now. He's still writing songs. And he had a normal life. And I guess they were living in Iowa. And he told his wife that, you know, he wanted to move to Nashville and write songs. And she was a nurse, and she said, oh, okay, well, let's do it. And they packed up the family and moved to Nashville. And he ended up writing songs for George Jones and Tanya Tucker and Charlie Pride and Reba McEntire. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
I don't know how to tell her she don't love me anymore.
Yeah, I think when I first moved to Nashville, my mom thought like that he would just hook it up, like, oh, he's got the key to the door, like, it's cool, we'll let you in. So I went to his house and I played him a couple songs that I wrote, and I got done and he just kind of sat there in silence for a while. And it made me very nervous. And then he told me basically to go back to my apartment and get rid of my computer and my TV, my radio, and just keep writing songs because those weren't good enough.
Wow.
And I mean, he was right. And I knew that. I'd been going out to all these like open mic writer nights and like just tried to study like what made a song good, and you know, like having a little bit of humor and having a theme. And yeah, I'm really thankful that he did that.
What's he said recently?
Oh, he's so supportive. I mean, yeah, he couldn't be more proud. They come out to my shows and
wow,
and whatnot. And we went over and co-wrote with him a couple times, and he has this like long list. It's just pages and pages of like song titles and like things that people say in everyday conversation that he's like, pick out a title, let's write a song. And then he gets out his boombox with a cassette tape and hits record. You know, we're there with our iPhones, like, let's make the demo. And then we got done writing the song, and he pulled out a contract. And Jeremy, you sign here, and we'll sign, and you sign here, and then we all, then we know who gets credit on the song.
That's old school Nashville.
It's old school.
Wow.
Blood is not.
Didn't even wait till the body's cold, right?
You know, yeah. It's like... We could keep you guys all day, but you've gotten a long road ahead of you. You're going to play one more song for us, right?
Sure.
Is this going to be a new one or something from the album? What are you going to do, Margo?
I think we're going to end with All American Made here.
The title track.
Yeah, the title
Wonderful
track.
Song.
It ain't the single, but it's my favorite.
What's a single in this streaming digital age? They're all singles.
If you play them separately, they are. Woke up from a movie I immediately forgot. Got a heartache on the bottom and a headache on the top. The part of me that hurts the worst is the one I just can't spot. And it's all American made. And everywhere I go, somebody puts me in the dirt. And everything I say, somebody says they said it first. But I don't need 10 million, baby, just give me one that works. It's all American made. Well, all the Midwest farms are turning into plastic homes, and my uncle started drinking when the bank denied the loan. Now it's liver failure and his mad cow being cloned, and it's all American made. Well, I have been all over, but I can't help feeling stuck. Something in my bloodline or something in my gut says go to California in a rusted pickup truck. It's all American made.
Yeah.
gets any sleep at night. If the folks on welfare are making it all right. But I'm dreaming of that highway, baby, and it stretches out of sight. And it's all American made. It's all American made. It's all.
What a great song for our times. All American Made from Margot Price with Jeremy Ivey and Luke Schneider. Margot, can't thank you enough for coming in. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank y'all.
That wraps up our conversation with singer and songwriter Margot Price. We've got videos of her performance, and you can find those at soundopinions.org. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, we're going to be reviewing some new albums by Nico Case, Parquet Courts, and we're going to tell you what the heck is Kanye West up to now.
We're also working on our Best Albums of 2018 So Far list, and we want to hear from you. Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message with your favorite album of the year so far and why. Special thanks this week to Adam Yaffe and Goose Island for the Margot Price performance. Sound Opinions is produced by Brendan Banizak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, and this week we welcome our newest staff member, Andrew Gill. On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic, so give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Long distance operator, placeless call.
New messages.
This is Betty from Sarasota, originally from Montreal. I was just thrilled with your dissection of the Blue album by Joni Mitchell.
California, oh, California, coming home.
I was a singer, a professional singer my whole life, and she is my all-time hero. I think she's really the most important figure in the last 50 years as far as women artists, for her prolific songwriting, her gorgeous singing, and her great artistry. So I love Joni Mitchell. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Hey, Sound Opinions. This is Justice from Nashville, Tennessee. I am 25 years old, and I just listened to your Joni Mitchell dissection. I love A Case of You.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star, and I said.
And I grew up listening to this album with my mom and my dad, and I can just remember after my mom and dad split, and my mom would just sing her heart out about A Case of You. And it felt like so much back then, and then now to be older and just to have felt the same way about someone else and to have seen her pain and hard Joni Mitchell goes, just saying that, yes, of course, I can outdrink anyone and feel as hard as anyone else can is just so emotional and raw and good. Yeah, and I appreciate you guys.
I could drink a case of you. And I would still be on my feet. I would still be on.
Hi guys, this is Wendy calling from Clearwater, Florida. I just listened to the Joni Mitchell episode. and absolutely loved it. You hit the nail on the head in so many ways. I particularly liked your comment on A Case of You when you were saying about talking about all of the different opinions on who the song was about. Was it about her love affair with Leonard Cohen, or was it about still about Graham Nash? And you said, really, who cares? And that's true. It's there's a truth to her songs that transcends whoever it was she was singing about at the time. Love your show. Bye.
This is April from Clinton, New York. I was thrilled to find your new episode was a dissection of Joni Mitchell's classic album, Blue. I was especially interested in the portion where Lindsay Zolatz addressed the idea of Joni Mitchell's legacy and talked about the passing on of the music from mother to daughter and about Joni's influence on young women. So as a huge Joni Mitchell fan myself and mother of a boy, I like to think that there was some formative influence seeping in from Joni's songs, which comprised a good portion of my son's evening lullabies. And then I had little doubt that they were in fact seeping in when one day, while I was settling him into his car seat, he started singing You Turn Me On the Radio and sang it right through to the end. I think he was about 5 at the time.
Oh, honey, you turn me on. I'm a radio. I'm a country station. I'm a little bit corny. I'm a wild flower waiting for you. Broadcasting town.
And then he turns 28 this year, and I'm so pleased to have brought Song and Joni Mitchell into his life. And I'd like to think that it contributed to the generous and thoughtful man who joined me last year on January 21st in the Women's March in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for your show, and especially for this great episode. Bye.
Down the line, but you know, I come when you whistle and you're loving them kind.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.